express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
And welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. This is our weekly program covering arts and arts events in Valparaiso and throughout Northwest Indiana. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Our theme music you heard is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Underwriters for Art on the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum, regional art patron Mary Levan, and our landlord, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. If you'd like to find out more about leasing space in this historic building, please give Walt a call, 219-462-5821. I'd like to thank them for their generous support. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager, and Tom Maloney, vice president, radio operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and is part of the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. That's artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. Our program, along with all of our programs, are streaming live at wvlp.org. Art on the Air is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m. Our shows are carried by Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., and you can hear them at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Our entire show archive can be heard at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. And make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Art on the Air, WVLP. Art on the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art on the Air and, of course, the WVLP station, we'd be happy to become part of the WVLP family anytime. Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there or at wvlp.org/support. So don't just be a WVLP and Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air and the whole WVLP family. Join the WVLP family today. And now in this segment of Art in the Air Spotlight, we have someone who's been here before, Captain Ambivalent, and he's a nerd rock singer, songwriter, superhero that's boldly battling the market forces of 2005. Well, anyway, he's got a special event coming up, and unfortunately, it's going to be virtual because it's so hard to do that. But Captain Ambivalent, otherwise known as Dan Beamer, welcome to Art on the Air.
Hey, thank you.
Aloha.
Good to be here.
So, tell us about what you've got coming up. You have a new adventure coming up that's going to be all virtual.
Yes, indeedy. So, basically, like everybody else, my live performance gigs kind of disappeared. And I'm based in Valpo in Northwest Indiana, but we're pitching a show for the Elgin, Illinois Fringe Festival. But that's okay because it's online, so you can get it from anywhere. It'll be just like you're seeing me in Valpo. It's a video show, and it's available for a 24-hour rental through the Elgin Fringe Festival .com website. And there'll be some live chat events along with it. And there's about 11 other artists that are doing very different work there. So there's a good variety.
How long does it run?
It runs, it's running now until October 4th.
Okay, very good. And how do they find it? Where do they, the website, or how do they locate that?
ElginFringeFestival.com.
Okay.
Or you can always check.
How long is your performance on it?
52 minutes, 52 and a half minutes.
Wow. Like it's a big show. Great.
Yes, it's a full show. Yeah. It's a all the tickets are $5. There's also a festival pass to see multiple shows, and I don't know the details on that, but they'll be on the website.
Now, you have several of your characters that will be in this.
Congratulations. Wow.
Your tell us a little bit about some of the characters other than Captain Ambivalent that will be there.
So, So doing it virtually is an opportunity to do things a little bit differently. So maybe about a third of the show is kind of like seeing a live Captain Ambivalent show, except that there could be maybe some backup singers and dancers who are everybody's me. And then we sort of go off on a journey on a toy train to a bunch of different locations. And there's a total, I think, of 12 different characters that you will meet through the course of the show. They're all me and my costume collection.
You have a sample of those that you've supplied for us. So let's take a listen to that. Captain Ambivalent at his In Denial show at the Elgin Friends Festival.
In a socially distant world beset by evil, one singing superhero has the courage and the privilege to stay home and play with toys.
You might call me Captain Ambivalent. Then again, you might not.
Hey, want to play G.I. Joes?
Then again, you might not.
Hey, want to play dinosaurs?
With his imaginary friends, Buford P. Wallaby.
The House of Memory is old, its walls are full of holes.
Guy Slamet.
I am the most sexy man in your life.
And more.
Hey, everybody, let's do the badass walk.
Whatever life will throw my way, I'll greet it with a smile.
Captain Ambivalent is in denial.
How do we get there?
Well, first you close your eyes, and then you go on the internet.
And that was Captain Ambivalent in Denial. You can hear that at the Elgin Fringe Festival.
So, Captain, what is next? We've got the Fringe Festival on its way. What are you working on now?
I'm taking things one step at a time. This is my big focus. The past, 7 weeks have been very intensive on this. And then, we'll just have to see what.
But you're comfortable with this online. So maybe we can collaborate.
Yeah. So maybe I'll probably be looking at doing some more video things now that I finally had my studio set up to be able to handle it. When the pandemic first started, I was really kind of unprepared. I had only recorded things for albums and recorded music, and I wasn't set up to record live or record video, and now I am. So who knows what's going to come next.
Well, the last time we spoke, you said you were doing some more writing. Did that writing include any more songs? Is there going to be another album soon?
Yes, there should be another album soon. I was working on sprucing up a musical I worked on in college to be able to pitch, and actually one song from that opens up this virtual show, the End of the Show.
Excellent.
Very good. Well, why don't you tell our audience one more time how they can find you on the Elgin Film Festival and what to expect.
Okay. ElginFringeFestival.com, or you can always, CaptainAmbivalent.com is my place. You can expect a whole bunch of funny songs sung by a bunch of different funny characters and some surreal absurdism. It'll be just pure joy.
Excellent.
David Bowie, too.
Well, there we are. We have Captain Ambivalent here on Art of the Air Spotlight. Thank you once again for being on Art of the Air. And we look forward to it. It's currently running through October 4th. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air, a wonderful company offering custom artwork, promotional personal projects, multimedia ready artwork, custom traditional art from logos to flash art, everything like that. And that's our guest, Marco Salazar. Welcome to Art on the Air.
Hello.
Aloha.
Hola.
Well, Marco, what we want to first ask about is kind of your background, where you grew up, your whole educational thing. I always like to say from where you were to where you are now. So tell us a little about Marco.
I'm born and raised here in East Chicago, my hometown. I went to Holy Trinity School. I ended up going to Bishop Knoll. I took private art classes when I was in seventh grade. My teacher and one of the parent-teacher conferences told my mother that I like to draw a lot, and I was really good at it. She used to always have me do the decorations in the classroom. So my mother found a lady in town, Miss Radich, if I could throw her name out there. She was a retired art teacher from, I believe she taught at the Art Institute of Chicago. And she taught in her basement a couple days out of the week. And she taught high school and college students that were advanced. And she didn't want to take me because I was only 11 years old. It's in seventh grade. But my mother presented her with my portfolio of drawings and sketches and colorings. And she made an exception and she took me in. And I got my first real exposure to the fundamentals of art and coloring and painting and all those lovely things. And I had my first gallery show when I was 12 at the, which is now South Shore Arts, but back then it was the Indiana Arts Association. So I've been painting since then. I've got, I was awarded some scholarships to go to art school my senior year of school. I had to decline those because at the time I had a girlfriend. My girlfriend at the time became pregnant, so I had to put that aspirations on hold, and I enlisted into the U.S. Army and served in Desert Storm and got an honorable discharge and was able to hit the floor running at the next semester for art school. So I ended up going to the Art Institute of Chicago, American Academy of Art, and got a degree in Columbia College in graphic design and film and video.
Well, first of all, thank you for your service. Appreciate that. And wow, what a story and everything like that. So tell us a little bit about your art. What kind of art do you do? What your mediums are?
I kind of dabble in a wide range of mediums. When I was coming up very young, I used to love comic books and cartoons, and that kind of got me into the whole animation part. So when I did go to Columbia College, I did do a small internship with Warner Brothers working on a Tiny Toons cartoon. So I used to do animation. And then at the time growing up as a teenager, the whole hip hop graffiti art movement was well on its way. So I dabbled in large scale murals and applications, all legal, by the way, commissions and whatnot on local businesses and stuff. So and then taking my traditional formal art training with Miss Radich in that school, I had a very keen sense of portraiture. So I just used to dabble in pen and ink and any kind of mediums I could really get a hold of, watercolor, color pencil, painting, oil, acrylic, aerosol, ketchup and mustard, et cetera, et cetera. No, yeah, I just like to experiment with different things. And I know there's artists that are well-versed in particular mediums, and I just like to expand my horizons and kind of work in different things. And as I got older, I got into the automotive field and airbrushing. I opened up a store at the local mall here in Hammond, Indiana, which is now, it was raised back a couple of years ago, Woodmar Mall. I opened up a t-shirt shop there when I was 21 doing airbrushing. It was called Airtime Airbrushing, if anybody remembers that. Yeah.
Well, I remember a story you told me, and maybe you can expand on it, on that thing that you just said, totally legal. Wasn't it in your neighborhood that the owners of, in the alleyway, they let you paint their garage doors? Can you talk a bit about that? That was like a fabulous offer.
Yeah, I mean, we were always looking. And when I say we, I hung around with fellow artists growing up, graffiti artists, and we ran together like a crew. And whenever we got space, public space to put up murals, I mean, we always seized on it. And especially if we can make a couple dollars from it, you know, from local businesses, that would help us restock on spray paint and cans of, you know, gallons of paint and stuff like that. So, yeah, we got kind of prolific in the area as far as doing, you know, local car lots and mom and pop stores and neighborhood stores like that. So, yeah, that was that kind of gave me the whole entrepreneur insight of, making a living on what I do.
I remember also in that conversation that we had, and this was, I don't know, like 8 years ago, and it stuck in my mind completely that graffiti is America's genuine folk art. And absolutely. So taking So taking that though, like, and I think it was probably in the mid 80s, because I was working in an art industry there, and that's kind of when graffiti got co-opted sort of mainstream. So how did that affect all of you? And I mean, like the true graffiti artists.
Yeah, well, you know, like I referenced before, graffiti art, it's a global phenomenon now. It's used by the fashion industry, the music industry, and advertising and marketing and media companies. But it's born here in the United States. It's as American as apple pie and jazz and the blues. And when it started hitting the commercial scene, we kind of rode with it. So we picked up commission works, working for film companies, doing background sets and local theme parks. We did the Batman ride at Six Flags Great America. I mean, we were teenagers. We're doing the backdrops to those scenes. And I mean, it was just overwhelming. We felt like rock stars. So, yeah, we kind of went with the flow and tried to capitalize with it, you know.
And so then what happened afterwards, though? Is there a point where that changed? Because it's still so prevalent.
Yeah, I mean, my fellow colleagues that I grew up painting with, I mean, everybody went to their own different realms. I have a buddy of mine who still does prop and set design in Chicago. I have another buddy who does large format advertising outdoors. You know, he does large scale murals and stuff. And we all still are in the industry, and we're all living through our art. This is what we do for a living. And that's one thing that I'm happy and proud to say.
The question I have, Marco, is with the pandemic, how's that affected you not only personally, but also with your art and studio and your operations and everything?
I have a closed studio. So whatever I work on, commission work, I either mail them, deliver them, or even if I do my large scale applications, I'm usually doing it on site, maybe with another helper. So I'm never really engaging with the public in close proximity. I really never had my place open to the public. So it really doesn't affect me. And then nowadays I'm doing a lot of digital illustration. So that's mainly, through email or Dropbox, where they can, they can download the high resolution images that I work on, and then I do the financial aspect. I use PayPal and things like that. So I never really have to come in direct contact with anyone.
Do you ever want to have like a public studio? Would you like to do that sometime?
Yes and no. I have done that in the past. I've had a retail studios where people can walk in and check out my work and maybe order commissions and things like that. But in the age that we live in now, I mean, brick and mortar, I mean, that's the main industry that really took the hit, because you can't really house or have people here. So I utilize kind of like the digital age, where I use my website, I use digital marketing and things like that, social media. And I do pick up commissions and jobs through that, where I don't really need to engage with people personally. You know, I am a people person, and I've taught junior high art for 8 years, and I took a leave about a year ago. So that's one of the things I really do miss, is engaging students. I used to teach seniors. I used to teach kids. I did the wine and canvas thing. I did the bruise and brushes and pizza and paint for the kids. Yeah. So those things I do miss. I do miss the one-on-one interaction with students. But aside from that, as far as my creative time, I really don't engage with visitors too much, which is okay.
So I know you formed the United Cultural Arts Association. Is that still going on?
That was early in 2000s with my group of fellow artists that we grew up painting. That was one of our ways of kind of going, giving back to the community. So we formed this non-for-profit 501c3 organization, and we used it to sponsor mural projects with the local schools. And we did that for a couple of years, you know, but again, you know, we each were pulling in different directions. So we kind of disbanded in the early 2000s. Yeah.
So what project are you working on now? Do you have any outdoor murals on?
I am working closely with my mayor here in town. They've been very supportive of public art. They have art throughout the city, and they not only commission national artists to come and do installations in the local parks, but they kind of tap me for different projects, large scale projects. Several years ago, I did a big mural outside of Ameristar Casino by what is known as George Park Beach here in East Chicago. It's slated to be one of the largest outdoor murals in North America. It's on the side of one of the exit ramps coming off of Klein Avenue to the casino. I also painted the ramps leading over to the beach. They're known as wayfinding graphics. So they're these big, colorful, geometric shapes that they say lakefront and have arrows pointing so that you can follow the direction to the beach. And then now we're working on a project with the mayor. They're renovating here the local stadium, baseball stadium, which is Block Stadium. One of our local athletic heroes is Mr. Kenny Lofton, who is in the Cleveland Indian Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. He's from East Chicago, and it's known as Kenny Lofton Field. So what I'm doing is I'm doing a big, huge mural that's endorsed by the Major League Baseball with his image on there, and has all his stats, and kind of give the young youth who are playing baseball kind of a motivation on to strive for the highest field, which is Major League Baseball.
Tell us about being a Grumbacher artist. What's involved in that?
Grumbacher artist. Grumbacher is a manufacturer of art supplies, paints and brushes, and mainly on the academic level. So one of the main suppliers is Michael's Craft Stores, which I taught painting workshops here in Highland, Indiana, at the Michael's there. So I had to get certified as a paint instructor in order to offer the workshops there. So I still maintain that certification as a Grumbacher paint instructor.
And you talked about the middle school, junior high level. What kind of projects did you do with them?
That was a year-long curriculum that was based on the standards of brought on by the Indiana Board of Education, just teaching fundamentals, design, composition, the color theory, different things. And it's very ironic that we mentioned that, because when I was one of my first art shows that I submitted my oil paintings was in seventh grade, was a junior high art contest, which was sponsored by the South Shore Arts at the time. And when they did have the art gallery show, my mother was so proud. She's my greatest supporter. She's my greatest fan. She's the one who pushed me when I was very young to pursue the art. She was so ecstatic. She got me dressed in my Sunday's best, and we went as a family. And we went to the show, and we did two rounds in the gallery, and we could not find my paintings. I mean, there was junior high artwork, such as watercolors and paper mache sculptures and things like that. But my oil paintings were nowhere to be found. They ended up not being exhibited, and they were stored in one of the utility rooms next to the boiler and the furnace, which enraged my mother. She had some kind words with the manager that day. But the irony on that is that I became an art teacher. I took my students to participate in which is now the junior high Tri-County Art Show. We were the only school out of East Chicago to be selected to exhibit. I had four students, and out of four students, two of them took awards and prizes. So that was like a 360 for me. I was very gratified with that.
So could you take a moment just to tell people where they can see your art? I know you have merch. Do you still have t-shirts and all the stuff that you used to have? T-shirts available?
Absolutely. Well, I dabble a lot in different things. I love putting my artwork where they're practical and functioning, and I have masks and T-shirts and things like that. And I have them on my virtual store, which can be found at marcoart.net.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
I know. I love my T-shirt.
You're welcome.
You're wearing the one that I have right now.
Yeah, I'm wearing an old one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about some of the art. Now, I know our audience can't see it because it's a radio show, but tell us some about the art in the background. I noticed that one, like a vocalist and everything. And that's like, how do you do that? What's that done on wood? Or explain that.
That's different mediums. The one you're referring to is a life-size wooden cutout of Selena Quintanilla, which is the queen of Tejano music. I had a chance to see her when she was alive, and she's from the same part of Texas that my family was, and so, you know, I paid reverence and made a life-size cutout of her. Close to 6 feet tall, and it's illuminated from behind. But that is painted with aerosols and airbrush. The painting too, which would be my right, which is a black canvas, which depicts the Day of the Dead. That one there is painted in acrylic. The one next to it is painted in enamel and pinstripe. I do pinstriping, automotive pinstriping. And then I have a couple of oil paintings back there, too. So I've got my whole portfolio on my website that people can feel free to look at.
And you do take commissions?
Absolutely. Yes, I do.
Oh, great.
Yes, I do.
So do you have time for your personal work? Because I've noticed that, you know, your commission list is huge. And the murals, I know, take a lot of time. Are you able just to approach a canvas and just do something that is just inspired by you?
I like painting in series. So I don't know, you can kind of see back here. I usually put up like three or four canvases, and I paint them periodically in stages. So I'll do all the backgrounds on all five canvases at once. Then I'll do the midground on all five canvases at once. And then I'll do the foreground on all the canvases at once. So this way I have a series. So once I have the series, if I have an exhibition or a show or I set them up as a set. Like all of these here are parts of a set. These are the lonely ones that got left behind. Those are the ones that I got left. So I hold on to those and I display them here at my shop. And different series, I usually have different mediums. I usually have different themes. I usually have different. There's no two sets that look the same. They're all different.
Are they mixed? Do you stick with one medium when you're doing that, or do you mix? Does spray paint work its way into?
No, it? I usually stay within the medium. So if it's an oil painting, I usually strictly stick to oil. If it's acrylic, or I usually stay with that. The only ones that kind of intermix are the aerosolics, which are like spray paint and airbrush, things like that, where they kind of have the same texture, the same feel, the same kind of. You know, the theme to it.
Do you like airbrushing better than using an aerosol can because you have much better control?
No, I'm kind of like one of those perfectionists where I'm a compulsive where that if I pick up a medium, I practice day and night until, you know, I study works of other artists that use that medium. And I want to get just as good as they can get because, you know, everybody puts on their pants the same way in my eyes. And I figured, you know, if I study the technicalities of it and become a little bit the disciplines, I can kind of get to the mastery of them. So I've gotten into pinstriping. I got into airbrushing. When I had my store doing the airbrushing, that's all I did was airbrushing. So I would run into people and they would say, oh, you're the airbrush guy. And that would burn me up. You know, oh, you're the T-shirt guy. Oh, that would burn me up. So I would leave the airbrush alone and focus on something else. So the spray can, I can do pretty much very close to what I can do with an airbrush with a spray can.
And like I told you also, it was like watching a dancer perform when you're, because you get so, I mean, you are so laser focused on what you're doing. And it's just beautiful to watch you move as you're working because you're, you're completely unaware of anybody else. You're just like totally one with your material. And it was like watching a dancer.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. One of those things that helped discipline with that was when I was in college, I answered a call for a caricature and airbrush artist for a company called Fazen Arts, which owns all the novelty concessions and all the Six Flags. So if you go to a Six Flags over Dallas, or if you go Six Flags in St. Louis, or even here in Gurnee, you're going to see the t-shirt booth, you know, with Billy Love Sue and a heart design, which is airbrushed. And right next to it, you're going to see the caricature artist drawing people in the cartoons. And when I went, they were looking for either a caricature artist or an airbrush artist. But again, I used to love to experiment on different techniques, on different mediums. I got hired to do both. So I worked at Six Flags in Gurnee for a summer. And then they sent me to, which was the brand new casino at the time, Excalibur Casino in Las Vegas. So I got to work there. I lived in Vegas for about a little under 3 years. But you have to draw in front of people. You know, I had people standing, crowds of people standing over my shoulder as I drew. And at first, it was so nerve-wracking. I mean, it was hard to hold my pencil because my hands were so sweaty all the time. But as I kind of perfected the techniques, I got more comfortable. And next thing you know, there were just shapes behind me. So when I do things like that, I'm able to kind of block that out and kind of focus. And I kind of got into painting live. I did live painting. Well, I did one with you when we did the car.
I know.
But
I know.
I would do stuff for local music festivals. We did the Lakefront Fest here in Hammond. We did some stuff for Lollapalooza, where we would just paint at the beginning of a band's concert. And when we're done, the band would throw up their guitars and drumsticks, and we would throw up our spray cans because we were done. And that's one thing I miss.
So, Marco, tell us what you have planned for the future, and also remind our audience how to get in touch with you.
I have some outdoor public art pieces that I'm looking at doing here in the city of East Chicago. One is a Major League Baseball, and another one is painting some water tanks, 45-foot-tall water tanks depicting local athletes, basketball players endorsed by the NBA. Anybody wants to see any of my work, you can find me online at marcoart.net, MarcoArt.net.
Okay, well, thank you so much. It's Marco Salazar, artist from East Chicago, based doing custom artwork, promotional projects. Anything you want, get a hold of Marco. Thank you for being on Art on the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And now a very special musical treat during the pandemic from Billy and Renee Foster, their new song called Virus.
Corona, Corona, stay at home. Essential workers, this really shows that they are our real heroes. Thank you. stay at home. If you can, Corona is on the sea. The life you say could be yours or one of your family. Put on your mask, pull on your gloves, don't take a chance and spread this virus. Social distance, it's up to you. We can save lives, it's true.
And now on Art in the Air, we feature Jenny Takas, who's in Valparaiso. She's driven with a deep connection to nature, a desire to relay her vision in the most direct manner possible. And she grew up in Chicago, but has a great story about how she got into painting. Welcome to the show, Jenny.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, our audience would like to hear a little bit about you or your journey from everything, like from where you grew up, so where you were to where you are now, and even things outside of art.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Chicago. Then we moved in to Oak Lawn, but always had a connection to the Indiana Dunes because my grandparents owned property, just land, in Beverly Shores. So as kids, we used to come out and parents would have picnics and we'd climb the dunes and always loved it here. So eventually my parents decided to build in Beverly Shores. So that's how I got out here to Indiana, but always loved nature and had a friend who had a house, grandparents' house, out in Westville, which is pretty close to Valpo. But in Chicago, it seemed like a long way. And I always loved going out there and just exploring. And so I'm more connected to nature than like the cities. Eventually ended up in Munster, Valparaiso, and actually I moved to Miller recently.
Oh.
Wow, very good.
It's a very nice artist community.
It is, and I can see the lake right here. I'm like across the street from the lake. So I never thought I'd be this close to the water, but you can do it in Miller. So.
You know, outside of your art, Jenny, what else did you do? You were, worked in banking of some kind?
Yeah, I was a loan officer. A mortgage loan officer for 23 years with Centier.
Oh, okay.
Centier Bank.
You're...
Yeah, well, I started painting... Well, I was always drawing. I'm probably going to date myself. I remember they used to get the newspapers and have all those illustrations, so I would copy those as a kid. So I loved doing that. And then I painted a little bit in my teens and into my 20s. And then for some reason, I just didn't think I had talent. So I quit doing it for a while until my son came along. And then I started drawing little cartoon characters and things for him. And then people said, well, these are really good. I didn't know you could draw. And then from there, it was just like...
When did you start including nature in what you were drawing? And what were those first materials that you used for your sketching? Was it graphite? Was it...
Yes. Pencils. And then eventually I did go into... I was very much into pastels. So I did a lot of pastel painting. And I worked myself up to the oils, which are nice and forgiving. I did watercolor too. I've done them all.
Well, you said that like experimentation is one of the most rewarding parts of painting. Can you explain what experimenting consists for you?
Just trying different techniques and styles as much as possible. You never know what you're going to be drawn to. So you've got to really, you can go to school or you can learn all you can and then you've got to apply it. And then eventually your own vision, your style will come through eventually. It takes a while.
So you're mostly doing oils, but do you have another medium that you like to balance that with? Or
well, I do have lots of pastels sitting around in paper. I kind of got away from it because framing was such a difficult thing. And I do love the fact now because I paint with a knife many times. So getting it nice and thick and oils the way to go with that.
Yeah, your most recent ones are like that, using the palette knife, it seems, almost exclusively.
Right. I really like that. I'd like to even get it thicker if I could. Not that.
You recently had an exhibit at Chesterton Art Center. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think I had over 35 paintings. I went to both galleries. We had a really nice opening. We had quite a nice turnout, I think. And I got a lot of feedback on my paintings. I put it in a book out there to say, you know, what was your favorite painting? Not that I would paint to their like, I just want an idea what people are attracted to.
What were they attracted to?
A variety. There was no, nothing really stood out like that was the painting. But so I felt like it was good. I'd made sales before, during, and now I've got from the show, people have given me a few commissions to do. So.
Oh, wonderful.
We would like to explore how COVID-19 has affected you, Jenny. Some artists actually embrace it, and it's a great thing. And some of them, it's been a difficult thing and everything. So tell us how it's affected you and maybe what you're looking forward to after the pandemic has passed.
Yeah, well, you know, being an artist is solitary anyway. Most of your art is done solo. So though I do have a group I go out to, which I maybe like to talk, my plein air group that we meet and go out to. But it's, so, you know, it really hasn't changed that much for me. What I have found out is people are home more and they're looking at their walls more. And I think sales are good for that reason. They're like, you know, we really need something here. So I think they're decorating. And online business hasn't stopped people. The galleries probably do have a little, you know, had a problem getting people into the store, but it really hasn't affected me that much. And I think sales have been good. And we do have a group that we meet. It's our Duneland Plein Air Painters. And we have started meeting again, but we're separating, of course, when we paint and when we do our critiques, we're away from each other. So we're socially distancing.
Well, we appreciate you being on Art in the Air. That's Jenny Takas. You can find her on takasartstudio.com or on Facebook in the same way. You can also get in touch with her things. Jenny is driven by her deep connection with nature and desire to rely on her vision in the most direct way possible. Jenny, thank you so much for being on Art on the Air. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Adam Seltzer, who's an author who does all kinds of neat stuff. He's a historian, novelist, he's published over 20 books, but he's also, most importantly, a tour guide and done that for more than a decade. Takes you all through. He's been on the History Channel, Travel Channel, and done shows like American Ripper, Mystery is at the Museum, and more. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Hey, good to be here.
Okay. Well, we'd like to ask you, first of all, about your own personal journey, how you got from, well, where you were to where you are now, where you grew up and all that.
I grew up in Iowa, where we're so by God stubborn we can stand touching noses for a week at a time and never see eye to eye.
Good old Music Man.
If you want Music Man references, I am locked and loaded, man. I can do this all day.
You got to remember, I'm a musical theater director, so I know most of those references.
Okay. Excellent. See how many I can work in over the course of an interview. After doing high school and college in Georgia, I moved to Chicago right after college, got a job with one of the tour companies, and since then I bounced around to several others based on whoever would micromanage me the least. So a lot of companies have their outlines ready to go. They want you to follow them, whether they're accurate or not, whether you think they're remotely interesting or not. So I bounced around between a few, and now I mostly work for myself. In the era that we have now, I've mostly been doing cemetery tours, but cemeteries aren't allowing groups this year for obvious reasons. They don't want to have more people to add too soon. So I switched in March, I switched everything over to virtual tours, and I found out really there's a whole world of people out there who would love to come on a Chicago tour, but they're nowhere near Chicago. And so now they can come on my tours from wherever they are. And I've been getting, having a really good response to it. It's been a lot of fun.
Where can they see your virtual tours? I mean, online, where can they?
It's all done on the Mysterious Chicago Facebook page. So facebook.com/Mysterious Chicago. Every morning at 10 o'clock, I do a mini tour where I just pick one location and walk around it a little bit for 5 or 10 minutes. Then at least twice a week, we do a full length tour. Tonight is one called Health Scares in History, which is a Graceland Cemetery tour that's all about our various cholera waves in the 1918 pandemic and Victorian causes of death. Then this Sunday is a presentation on unsolved mysteries in Chicago. Next Thursday is true crime stories from Chicago cemeteries. And then I think next Sunday I'll be doing a virtual architectural boat tour.
Excellent. Do you have any improv experience or background in that training? Because I mean, a lot of the stuff you're doing sounds like that would be
very theatrical.
Yeah, very theatrical.
I did some theater when I was a kid. Nothing really, I would say, formal training, but it is a kind of a similar skill set. And particularly in, I did have to hone my improv skills quite a bit running bus tours and boat tours, because you have to change up a lot just based on the traffic or how fast the various captains of the ship are going.
Are you planning any new tour type things? I mean, you're doing, it seems like you're churning out stuff all the time. So you think you might do something, let's say, outside of Chicago?
I also work in New York. Usually I'm there a couple of months a year. Mostly what I do there is take school groups around. We go to Broadway shows and the Statue of Liberty and all the stuff small town schools would take a school group to New York for. But then in off days, I run historical walking tours there as well. So we have branched out some. We're also doing a thing about once a month called virtual time travel pub crawls. So I thought it would be fun to do a virtual pub crawl. Then I realized, hey, we're not bound by time or space. We can go to bars and that haven't existed in 300 years.
And so what brings that? So how did it actually all come about? So did the tour company seek you out? Did you seek out the tour company initially?
I answered an ad on Craigslist initially. But then I started doing research to make sure I was getting the stories right. The ones they had taught me, some of them didn't quite seem accurate. So then I found out I had kind of a knack for finding new information about old stories, and eventually found more and more stories to talk about that were outside the purview of that company. And now I found myself writing books, coming up with a couple of new tours every month, building up a really large file of stories still to be told too.
So I guess research from one project might lead to the next.
All the time. I'll be in the microfilm room looking over a newspaper, and then there'll be a whole other article about some murder that everybody forgot about over in the next column. All the time. Some of my best stories I found while looking for something else.
I see in your bio there's a Star Wars character. How did that happen, yeah. And what is it?
In one of the books, Lost Stars by Claudia Gray, there's a character named Ron Adam, Captain Ron Adam. He's a flunky aboard Darth Vader's Star Destroyer. But he's named after my wife, Ronnie, and me. By Claudia Gray's a friend of ours. But that's what's going on my tombstone.
There you go. Very good. Well, you're also an author, so tell us a little bit about the books you've written.
That's really how I got my start, and I think it's what made me attracted to the tour companies to start with, is that I had a young adult novel published by Random House. For most of my 20s, I was working as a young adult novelist for most of my living, really. I don't really do that too much anymore, but I got sidetracked doing all of these Chicago history books and occasionally books about other weird historical topics that they'd asked me to research.
Are those books available like on Amazon or somewhere?
Most of them you can still get on Amazon. Some of them are out of print in print now, but the ebooks are usually still surviving.
What do you research for pleasure, or is it all?
It's all pleasure.
Well, yeah. but it's like when you're researching for a project, it's both exciting and frustrating. But do you have other areas that you're interested other than what you? I mean, you have like 20.
Oh sure, you know. I've never written a book about Bob Dylan, but I've read a million of them. I don't think the world needs a book about the Beatles by me, but I'll read any of them. I'll read pretty much any rock and roll book, really.
Yeah, because your writing is so interesting as well, and your tours too add so much humor to it. So I was compelled to read just those excerpts about out of all of them. And while I was doing that, I found all that music that you have out there.
Some of that's me and some of it's not. There's more than one Adam Seltzer out there. There's me and there's a guy in Portland who also does music. And we've been the two of us have teamed up to try to get Spotify to separate our stuff better. But it's a long process. But he's a nice guy.
Which one is you? Are you the one that...
I'm the Chicago one.
Well, as long as you get the royalty checks, I guess it'd be okay, you know,
so
that way.
I got one of his royalty checks one time.
So when you approach something new, like a new subject to do that, how do you go about that, researching it and figure out? Because, you know, a lot of this stuff is not in printed books.
Right. A lot of it, my first step is usually newspaper archives.
Okay.
That's where I'm most likely to find an actual interesting anecdote about someone. Like most of what I do these days has been related to cemetery tours. I'm doing a new Who's Who book for Graceland Cemetery here in Chicago. And I can look up like old town records and stuff that'll tell me what they owned, but I want to know what they were like. I want to like find an anecdote about them telling a joke or something. And you're more likely to find that in newspaper archives, or sometimes you can even find their diaries are still in a library someplace.
Okay, very good. And I wonder if you find, like, if people can give you oral history as a source also.
Not that often for people who are long gone. Most of the people I research don't have, are out of living memory at this point. So you'll get, like, family stories that are three or four generations of campfire stories. They're not necessarily more reliable than you'd find anywhere else.
Now, you also accessible on Facebook. Yeah, they can find your information there.
Yeah, just the Mysterious Chicago Facebook is the place to be these days.
Okay.
And that's where we hang out on a morning mini tour every day. A lot of, you know, the regular crowd shuffles in.
AstonishingChicago.com. That's one of yours also.
That's kind of like my my online business card, really. If you go to AdamChicago.com, it'll lead you to the Astonishing Chicago page, which lists all of my upcoming tours.
So were there any cases where you went into investigative mode thinking like for one way and then it turned out to be the complete opposite of what you thought going into it? Like you started out with what was a historical fact and it turned out to be...
Oh, that happens all the time. Probably the most famous example is people love to say that H.H. Holmes killed hundreds of people in this hotel during the World's Fair. He didn't even have a hotel. He said he was going to add a hotel to his building, but he never actually finished it or anything.
Tell us about your involvement with History Channel and Travel Channel and how did that happen? And you still do that?
They contact me. I've got a couple coming out, I think, in the next couple of years. And it's just kind of random. I'll randomly get an email saying they need somebody to be a talking head. Sometimes it's a case that I know nothing about. And that's another thing where being a writer and whatever improv skills I have come up, because they'll kind of give me a line and I'll have to feed it back to them three or four different ways. And I'll always research the case ahead of time so I know what I'm talking about by the time we start filming. Or often they'll call me to consult about H.H. Holmes stuff or Chicago stuff. And I'm not necessarily going to tell them what they want to hear. They want me to back up whatever they think is happening. Like the ghost shows will say, we want like the name and the address of this woman here who hanged herself from the ceiling in 1963. And I'll find out, well, that didn't happen. The woman who lived there in 1963 is still alive. That doesn't necessarily stop them from doing the show.
Do you ever think about doing other types of television locally? I mean, like hitting the stations?
If they ask me to, I will. It's not something I pursue normally.
So what are you working on now?
Right now, other than doing two or three tours a week plus a miniature one every day, that's kind of keeping me as busy as it can be right now. But I'm also finishing up the Graceland Cemetery book. And after that, I don't know what big project I'll do next. The tours have been keeping me, the whole idea of starting to do virtual tours was just to keep me occupied during quarantine. And it's succeeded a little better than I expected it to, as far as keeping me busy.
I've seen a couple of the mini tours, and they're just very entertaining.
Oh, thank you.
Especially if you have any Chicago background, it's like very nostalgic because you also bring up the, you know, what was there as opposed to what is there now.
Right.
Speaking of the COVID-19, how's that affected you? Well, you've talked a little bit about business-wise, but, you know, personally, and what do you look forward to after it's all over?
I look forward to going to concerts again. That's one of my bigger things. I miss concerts. I miss shows. I miss traveling. I miss New York terribly this year. You know, normally in the spring, I'm there a couple of months. I miss my school groups.
Esther did ask you what you got in the future. Is there any more books in your future as far as writing different things like that with other than Graceland?
Well, I've got a script written for a graphic novel called The Butts of Justice. It's about Churchill and Taft sailing around in a flying bathtub, teaching anti-conspiracy theory techniques, info literacy, how to battle conspiracy theorists. And I really just kind of wrote it as a joke, but increasingly I read the news and the world needs their butts, you know.
Was that one that you started a long time ago?
It was a few years ago that I wrote the first draft of it, but I read it recently like, yeah, this holds up.
That's happening to a lot of artists right now. They're revisiting old stuff, really realizing that it is relevant.
Yeah.
Larry, do you remember Les Bracken? That was the same thing that, you know, he wrote a song 15 years ago that applies right now.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and even one the people who write our theme show, they did a song called Coronavirus, you know, and they actually sing it. And it's kind of very jazzy and artsy, but it's sort of funny at how people are adapting to that. And we've done shows where we've actually talked to artists about how they're adapting to it. And some are, you know, actually flourishing in the thing, and others are not. So it's kind of an interesting thing.
It's kind of wonderful for you that way because you can have somebody check in from all over the world. So
right, I get people checking in from Australia. You know, they're probably not going to come clear to Chicago just to take a cemetery tour. But when they can do one from the comfort of their bathroom, why not?
Or in the middle of the night.
Right.
How do you know how many people, do you have a way of tracking how many people follow your tours online?
Yeah, it'll say when I'm broadcasting up in the top corner, it'll say how many people are watching at a given time. Just today, we had about 250 people watching. And it was funny, as I was walking down the street, and this woman opened her door and said, "What are you doing taking pictures of these houses?" Like, I got 250 people staring at you, lady. I should have said I'm looking for places to loot, but it's okay. Your stuff all looks like crap.
Excellent. So you just, I see in your bio you describe it as kind of a smart alecky novels that you've written about the history. So tell me about that writing style.
Well, I don't use it in every book, but usually my style of writing is very conversational. I want to work in jokes as much as I can. I don't really like dry histories that much. I tend to try to write the way that I talk. If a joke occurs to me, I'll put it in. The one exception is the H.H. Holmes book, where I felt like it would have been in kind of poor taste to throw in jokes most of the time. I worked a couple in. But in the paperback edition, there's an afterword where I talk about working on the TV shows and stuff that I did in my usual voice.
What is your usual voice? Let us
about,
hear your
about like I'm talking right now.
And then what's so your tour voice?
The tour voice is similar.
Yeah.
So in How to Get Suspended, how much is real and how much is made up?
Oh, it's mostly made up.
So that's not mom and dad in there, really?
No, well, I'm not so much like the kid in the book as I'm like his parents, really.
The recipes is what was really funny.
Oh, the recipes. But yeah, for those who don't know, in a few of my young adult novels, there are about a kid named Leon whose parents are what they call food disaster hobbyists. They find the worst cookbooks from the 1950s they can, the most disgusting recipes, then cook them and eat them to make fun of them. It's kind of like watching bad movies on purpose, except half the time you get diarrhea.
Well, I'll tell you what, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. Tell us all your website addresses, Adam, and where to go and how to find you.
Now, the easiest thing is just go to adamchicago.com. That'll link you to pretty much everything. The real parties are happening on facebook.com/mysteriouschicago.
Thank you. We appreciate you coming on Art on the Air. That's Adam Seltzer, and he does tours in Chicago. You can find out at those addresses. Thank you for being on Art on the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank our guests today for being on Art in the Air, which is heard every Friday at 11 a.m., rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m., and Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Your hosts are Larry Breckner and Esther Golden. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager, and Tom Maloney, Vice President, Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Underwriters for Art in the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum and Walt Breininger of Paragon Investments. Also, Mary Levan is our art patron supporter. Art in the Air is supported by the Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts-related event, exhibit, please email us at artontheair@gmail.com. That's artontheair@gmail.com. See you right here next week, 103.1 FM and 89.1 FM, Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.